Blog Talk Radio.
You have tuned in to the Brain Injury Radio Network with shows 7 nights a week. You can find the network at braininjuryradio.com or look up Brain Injury Radio Network on Facebook. Another Fork in the Road with your host, Donna O'Donnell Fugerski.
Hi, and welcome to the Brain Injury Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. My name is Donna O'Donnell Fugerski, and I am your host on my show, Another Fork in the Road. My show airs on the first and third Sundays of every month at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time. You can make your conversions all the way across the world, but if you're listening from Eastern, you would be 8:30 right now. Central would be 7:30 and 6:30 in Pacific, in Mountain Time, and 5:30, as I said, in Pacific. Another Fork in the Road is for anyone with a brain injury, anyone who is caring for a brain-injured person, or anyone with any interest in learning more about brain injury. Brain injury is not discriminating. It can happen to anyone, anywhere, and at any time. And believe me, it does. The Brain Trauma Foundation states that there are more than 5 million people in the United States alone living with some form of brain injury. But, you know, most folks do not even know about brain injury. And I know that I never did, not until it came to live on my doorstep. On Another Fork in the Road, I try to raise awareness of brain injury and to help folks to understand what survivors and caregivers experience. Brain injury is not a solo event. It does happen to the caregivers, to the family members, to the friends also. And we're going to be talking probably a little bit about that later. But on the third Sunday of each month, and that's today, I interview brain injury survivors or caregivers to see how they traverse their world of brain injury. I host therapists, medical professionals, and authors to gain insight into what they offer survivors. And on each first Sunday of the month, I host a discussion panel to examine pertinent topics related to brain injury, such as depression, neural fatigue is very common, anger and emotional problems, and various other symptoms of brain injury. And believe me, again, there are many. For those who are new to my show, here's just a little snippet about me. I came on the brain injury scene in 2005 when my husband David had a brain injury. And you can learn more about that on my blog, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. This is the point of the show. I always remember to say it's a good idea to have a paper and pencil nearby or something you can jot URLs or information down, because I often throw out a URL that you might be interested in to look at later after the show. But I shared David's and my story on this very show starting in August of 2014. I can hardly believe I've been doing shows twice a month for 8 years already. It just seems like the time has flown by. But the last show in November of 2014 that I did in that series, I featured a discussion with David. I also interviewed David on my April 19, 2020 show, for his perspective on his brain injury after 15 years at that time. We're already past the 17-year mark now. But because he was a retired professor of microbiology from Columbia University, I also wanted to get his understanding of the COVID-19 pandemic, because at that point in time, we were engulfed in that, and everybody was concerned and worried about COVID-19. And still, although it's subsided somewhat, it still lurks in the back of our heads, and it's still a problem. But you can find my archived shows on my blog at survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. So the shows will start back then in August of 2014 and run all the way till this show here, which will be posted in a day or two. So you can you will need to go on my blog, just what is it, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com, and then in the right sidebar, just click on the air show menu. There is another on the air, but you want to check the show menu. That's going to list all the shows I have done, probably more than 70 shows, I think, now. Probably wrong, probably more than 100. I don't know what it is. Go check it out. But you can find my archived shows on my blog right there at that On the Air show menu tab. And if you want to find out more about David, just check out David Figurski. F is in fun, I-G-U-R-S-K-I. And you can just put the name in the search bar at the top. So that's even easier if you want to do something, if you're looking for a specific person. So you can also read my complete story in my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, which was published by Right Life Publishing and was released in November of 2018. But you can find Prisoners, as I fondly call it, as a print book, as an ebook, and as an audiobook at all your local book cons or your local library. So when you read it, please write a review on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Goodreads, because a review is a book's best friend. And it helps let others know about a good read, as well as passing the word around about what is brain injury, what is a traumatic brain injury, and give people some insight into that. So go to my website, DonnaFigurski.com, to learn more about me. But you know what? If you just Google me, Donna Figurski, Donna Figurski, or Donna O'Donnell Figurski, you're going to know more about me than you may ever have wanted to know. So anyhow, tonight I hope that you're going to find my show fun and informative, and I also hope that you'll visit the shows of the other hosts on the Brain Injury Radio Network. There are shows every night between 7 and 10 p.m., and that's Pacific time. Again, just make your conversions in time. And you can also tune in at 5:30 p.m. Pacific time on weekends to listen to your favorite shows as well. Brain Injury Radio airs across the United States in every state and in 36 different countries across the world. So now, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. So let me just get started here. Just as a little intro to this story, this show, I want to just start with, slow down, you move too fast. How many of you can remember the lyrics to that song? Those lyrics from 59th Street Bridge song, more commonly recognized as Feeling Groovy, I don't know how to sing, so I'm not going to even try it, by Simon and Garfunkel, are words that apply to my guest tonight. If the driver that hit Jordan Fallard hadn't been speeding, I wouldn't be having this conversation this evening. That driver going way over the speed limit changed the path of a young woman embarking on her new life as an adult. That driver caused Jordan to have a traumatic brain injury and forced her to take another fork in the road, revising her plans and her dreams. So folks, remember those words by Simon and Garfunkel. Slow down. You move too fast. You may just save a life, maybe even your own. And, you know, it's really true. In this day and age, everybody seems to be going faster than fast. We're all in a hurry to get somewhere. And often we're in a hurry just to wait for something to happen. But you've got to think about that when you're, especially when you're behind the wheel of a car. It's not worth going that extra speed, that extra mile, getting there 5 minutes earlier, and causing either yourself or someone else so much pain. So now let me introduce Jordan Fallard. Hi, Jordan. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So glad you're on the show tonight. And I know your mom's in the background there, too, so I'm going to just give a shout-out to her. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello.
Hey. So, Jordan, we're just going to start right in with some questions. And one of the things that I always like to, well, not yet. I'm going to do this other one first. But you had your brain injury only about 2 years ago at quite a young age, which, again,
yes,
proves my statement that brain injury can happen to anyone at any age. Can you talk about how old you were, how you got your brain injury, how, yeah, just that kind of stuff now.
Just kind of the basis, for sure. So,
yeah.
Remember, this was COVID at the time. And so, like, I think, like, it was pretty deep COVID. So, February 5th, 2021. I was 23 years old, a month before my 24th birthday. And I had, it was a Friday, and I had just left work to film and study to get a test for my master's. And so I turned out of the parking lot of my work, and someone else was speeding. This was about 14 miles over the speed limit.
They were going 79.
They were on 79 or 45.
Oh. Whoa. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yep, and I was, so they were weaving in and out of traffic. And so there was no way I could have seen them. And then I turned left to go onto the road, the airport road.
Uh-huh.
And then he was just weaving in and out of other cars and just like basically hitting head on. So, but saved me that day was a fire department was called for backup on that same road. They turned around because they didn't need him anymore, and their captain saw the whole thing.
Wow, that was fortunate that happened, that he was right there. I've heard that story with someone else. It was very opportune at the time that when they had it, there was help immediately. It doesn't happen very often. So that's really very fortunate that was there. So what happened then?
So after that, I was taken immediately to, I was unconscious. I was stuck in the car. So they had to break the door off using the jaws of life, if you know what that is. Beaver clip, and they had to rip the door off and get me out of the car. And then put me in the fire truck to Mercy Hospital in St. Louis. And there I was in a surgery for about 5 hours. Because he had me going so fast, I was going so slow. My diaphragm ruptured. My stomach pushed on my lungs pushed on my stomach. My stomach pushed up on my heart.
Yeah.
So I couldn't. I was having issues breathing. Mm-hmm. And they realized that my diaphragm had ruptured. So I was in, well, how long surgery, Mom?
About a
five-hour surgery. Yeah.
Wow. That's incredible. So what happened with the other driver? Did he probably, what happened? I don't know.
So we're in the middle of all that.
So I'll tell this part because, of course, Jordan was, she was unconscious as soon as she was hit. And she did not regain consciousness for quite a while. So she has no memory of any of this time. She has no memory of that day, the month beforehand.
I have amnesia, retrograde amnesia. Have you ever heard of that before? Yeah. So what was the time, Mom? Like 2 years?
So
it's blurry up for two years before the crash.
Yeah. So for Jordan, 2021, before the crash was in February, in 2020, are very hit or miss. On what she remembers. But so the other driver was taken to the hospital, and I believe he had surgery. We did not know the extent of his injuries. From what I understand, they were pretty light. But at that time, our concern was Jordan. She was, fighting for her life. She had to be, she had acute respiratory failure. She had a lot of damage in the brain. And so that was our primary concern. But the other driver was taken to the hospital in a separate ambulance. We do know that.
Well, I mean, isn't that always the case? It seems like, the person causing it comes out light, and the other person is the one that's going to, suffer for the rest of their lives because of his or her life, because of it, because of their, it just makes me angry. It's so frustrating that happened to you. So I know that you said that you were in a coma for quite some time. So, and you also said that Jordan wasn't able to remember all that. And it's probably a good thing, because nobody wants to go back and think about what, the actual event, because it's scary, and it's like my husband had his brain injury. He had a subarachnoid bleed, and he remembers up to the point of the paramedics arriving in our house. And then he remembers nothing more for a very long time, because he was also in coma and also had brain surgeries. He had three brain surgeries in less than 2 weeks. So every time he'd start coming out of the coma, they'd give him another brain surgery and send him back down under. So he didn't remember any of that either. And I think that's probably healthy. It's probably much better not to have to have that haunting you, basically. So anyhow. Jordan, I'm interested to know, did you have anything you wanted to add before I go on?
So, yes, I do, actually. So, my parents they had no idea I was in a crash for how long, Mom? An hour at least?
So, this is Jennifer. The car accident happened at 5:01 p.m., and we didn't find out for about an hour. We actually found out kind of a roundabout way. Jordan at the time worked with my cousin. She worked for my cousin. And my cousin had left the office earlier. And so one of their previous coworkers, someone who they worked with, saw Jordan's car. Jordan drove a very recognizable car. She had a Chevy Smart, which is a really tiny car, and it was jalapeno green. So it was very recognizable. And so that person drove by and saw the car and the accident and thought it was very close to Jordan's work, that it was possibly Jordan. So they contacted my cousin, and my cousin sent me a message asking me if Jordan was at home. And I said, I don't know, because I was at work at the time. And I thought it was an odd message. So we have Life 360 detection on all of our family. So I pulled up the Life 360 and I zoomed in on her location, and I could see that she was at a hospital, but it still wasn't registering why she would be at a hospital. So then I was able to zoom in even closer, and I was able to see that she was actually in an emergency room, because the emergency room was a separate area of the hospital. And I can see that she was physically in the emergency room. And so at that time, it finally all started like clicking in my head, and I called my cousin, and my cousin told me that someone thought they had saw her car. And then I finally got it all together in my head that she was in a car accident. So I was able to call the hospital, and I asked them at the time, and they said a Jane Doe had come in. And I said, well, I believe that's my daughter. And they were able to confirm that it was her, and that she was already in surgery. And so that's kind of the story of how we found out.
Yep.
Wow. That's just incredible.
They even sent a police officer to our house, but no one was home because they found out through Life 360 before a police officer even showed up.
Yeah.
Huh. Wow. I never heard of that service. That sounds like it's very helpful.
Right.
Yeah. Jordan, can you tell our listeners what your life was like before that accident?
Yes. So I had graduated college. What year did I graduate college from? 2020. I graduated college and my bachelor's in 2020 with a degree in marketing.
And
I was working full time for a construction company where my cousin worked. And so I was very active with that. I loved my job and I loved doing it. And I was an advisor for my sorority that I was in a college. What else? Let's see. But yeah, I was just a very high functioning person. You know,
mm-hmm.
just
I like to be involved in things.
Yes.
How has your life changed now after the accident, since your injury? Is it better or is it worse? How would you classify that? It's a funny question. Let me go back a step there. Because I ask that question all the time in my interview on my blog. And it's a kind of a weird question. And it came about because when my husband had his brain injury, a friend of ours in my writing group had MS. So it's a form of an injury within the brain. And and she was quite talking to my husband one time, and she said, "So what do you think about your life now?" You know, David was an active professor. He had a very active scientific life in his, with lots of students and research going on. And then now he was, he wasn't able to do much. You know, he did go back to work eventually. But at this point, she asked him, "So what do you think about your life now? Is it better or worse?" And I thought that was an odd question, like, well, of course it's worse. What do you think? And so I asked her the question, and she said, "My life is better. I like me better. I'm a better person now." And another person recently, within the past several years that I've met through online, and she happens to be my co-author right now for the next book we're working on, and she says, she likes herself better. She's changed and she enjoys her life more now. Now, I know that a lot of people aren't going to say that everything is peachy keen and everything's great again, you know, great, and I'd rather have it this way.
Right.
But I was just surprised about those comments. And I was just curious to know what your thoughts were there.
Yeah. So my thoughts. So in some ways, it is better. I'm very close to my aunts. I have a very close relationship with them, especially now. I feel like I could call any of them at any time. Like, I have 4 or 5 aunts. So, but we're a lot closer now than we were before. I'm very grateful for that. But, I couldn't drive for a while, so that was kind of a bummer, for sure.
Yeah.
Just not, like, as involved because not working. So, like, just kind of feel kind of a little bit lost, if that makes sense. But now I'm getting my master's degree again, so it gives me a little bit of direction. So that's good.
Uh-huh.
And it just kind of allowed me to meet some very, very cool people that I never would have met before.
So
I do appreciate that, I guess. You say.
Yeah, you know, I agree with that totally. It's interesting. Now, again, I'm not sure. I mean, David and I talk about it. You know, is his life better now than it was before? I don't know. I think he probably would have preferred having everything remain the way it was and status quo and having the freedom that he had before the injury, because he's really confined a lot now because of his, he has a lot of physical disabilities, no cognitive difficulties, no problems with thinking and working things out or emotional, anything like that is fine. But he has a difficult time walking because of the brainstem injury, and that controls your balance. And he has many other things, with including ataxia and swallow disorder and some face paralysis, all physical. And so that it didn't affect his working. That did affect his working, but his brain, the brain injury didn't affect his going back to work and taking on more PhD students and teaching them and everything. However, it does affect him in how he can move about, get to places, his mobility. So, does he like it better or not? Do I like it better or not? No, if someone had asked me that question, I'd say, no, I'd rather go back. David's changed. He's a different person than he was before. I love him just as much now as I did before. But it is different. And it's interesting because, I feel like the man I married is not gone. That person is gone. And there's this new person that's arrived. And so it's really weird. Can you relate to that? Maybe Jennifer, can you relate to that at all?
I think she exactly. Well, for sure, I can definitely relate to that. You know, Jordan is definitely different than she was beforehand, and she'll never be the same. Her injuries keep her from being the same, and then the trauma and life. You know, she doesn't have that innocence anymore that she'll never be able to reclaim. She'll never be able to leave the house without knowing that someone, you know, could be driving a car and run into her. So it kind of takes away, you know, that safety net that you have in the world that you think you're going to be okay. So she'll never reclaim that. And she is different. She's, you know, and a long time ago, my husband and I decided when she was still very critical, and they were telling us, you know, that they didn't know if she would ever talk or walk or anything. And we always said, whatever Jordan we got is the Jordan we would love, and we would be happy with whatever we got. As far as she would go, we would love that, and that would be the Jordan that we have and love. And we do miss who she used to be, but there are good things about who she is now. She's very funny. She's witty. She is very interested in other people. She's interested in their stories and finding out about them. And so she has a happiness to her some days. Some days are hard, but a lot of days she's very happy. And so she is different. And, you know, you deal with that. It took us a long time to figure out that what we were dealing with was ambiguous loss. And once we had a name for it, I think Jordan herself and the rest of us could finally grieve, because we knew, you know, it's hard to grieve a person who's still alive. And many people don't understand that. I mean, she's alive. So what are you grieving? Well, you're grieving the person that used to be. You're also grieving the future that they had planned and the future that you had planned for them. So it's definitely really hard, but not everything is bad, you know, not everything is bad. And so there are good things about her and things that changed that are very positive. But that doesn't make life easier for her, though. That doesn't make these things
that she goes through physically and mentally, it doesn't make it easier. And I feel sorry for that.
Yeah, I get it. You know, as you were describing the new Jordan, I was thinking, are you talking about David? Because much of what you said was also much of what has happened, you know, affected with David. He's always been, you know, appreciates humor and everything, but he got downright hilarious. People would come over at not, it's not so much now, but this was like in the very beginning when he came home from the hospital or even in the hospital, the rehab, once he was able to, you know, get out of the actual hospital thing. But he was funny. He was really funny. He'd say these things and everybody would crack up and laugh. You know, and then they would say, who is he? You know, what happened?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he was much more serious. As a professor, he was much more serious and took his life seriously. Not to say he doesn't now, but it just was this other layer of him that we didn't see before that was released after the brain injury. And then one of the things I used to say, too, because he has changed. He's not the same person that I married, you know. And I know we go through changes all through our lives. But I always tell him, you know, it's like I've married a different man. I'm living with a different man now. The other guy is gone. And then David will tell him, well, that's his problem. Let him go. You know, it's like, well, because I'll say, well, who would you like better? And he said, well, you know, the other guy left, so this is me now, and I'm going to live. And he's very positive and upbeat about who he is and what he does and how he lives this life that's much more difficult for him than, like you said, with Jordan. You know, it's a different way of looking at things. So that's interesting that you're also saying kind of the same thing. And
Yeah. For sure. She is, it's funny now because Jordan she's the kind of person that if she's at the grocery store and you have a beautiful outfit on, she will be sure to tell you that your outfit is pretty or that your children are so cute or
strangers.
Yes. And I remember we were at a park when she was still in rehab and we were actually walking and there was, they were having a wedding and this lady had her wedding dress on and she looked gorgeous. And Jordan said, I just have to tell her how beautiful she is. And so she walked up and she said, can I tell you how beautiful you are? And I think the woman was very touched because I don't think in our daily lives that there are people that stop us and tell us, you know, that we're beautiful or that our children are beautiful or, you know, that they like what we're wearing or things like that. And I think she does appreciate those things, and she's not afraid to tell them to someone.
Yeah, it's a new appreciation that's foreign, and it's really, I mean, yeah, and I think people do respond to that. You're right, Jennifer. I think that people don't say it often enough to people. I like to do that. I've been known to interrupt people's conversations, strangers' conversations, and just, you know, tell them what I think, how wonderful they were doing something or whatever. But that's just me. That doesn't have to do with that. But it's interesting how the good does. There is a different side, and our brains are so it's a very complicated organ. And I think, as I understand it, I'm not positive if this is true because I think they're still studying it, but we only use a portion of our brain. And perhaps when the portion of it that was damaged, the new neurons are making themselves, are reconnecting, and maybe other parts of the brain are picking up and pull, you know, that weren't so active, weren't so important before. And I'm just guessing on all of this stuff, but I mean, I see that with David, and I see it with a lot of people that I speak with, that there is a different side to the personality that just emerges that maybe didn't happen before. Maybe it's because life has slowed down a little bit more for the person who has a brain injury, and they have time to do that because most of us are running so quickly through life. As I started my whole thing, slow down, you move too fast. And that that was for the car, but I mean, that's what I think that's a statement that we can all, you know, say that we're guilty of. So,
well,
but
brain injury definitely slows you down. Brain injury slows you down mentally and physically, and you know, the fatigue and emotionally. So Jordan deals a lot with fatigue. That's a big issue for her. Going through the day, just having enough energy to make it through the day. So you learn to prioritize, and she does. She definitely prioritizes what's important to her. So that day, visiting with a friend might be the most important thing, and that means that everything else has to go by the wayside so that she'll have the energy, you know, to be present and be with that person.
Is that called again?
Yeah.
What is what called?
You know, and
work to prioritize things.
Oh, we talk about spoon theory a lot. I'm sure that talked about spoon theory.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that into the conversation by Christine Miserando. I can never get her name right, but Miserando. And she had, I think she had lupus. And she was explaining that to her friends in a restaurant. And she couldn't get it across to them. And you know what this is, but I'm going to pop this out to the audience so they can also understand what it means to have neural fatigue, or what it means to prioritize your day. Because so Christine is trying to explain it to her girlfriend or her friend, and she is not able to get it across. And so they're sitting at a restaurant. She grabs all these spoons from another table. As the story goes, she grabbed 10 spoons and said, "This is all I have for the day. I can only have 10 spoons," and they represent the energy she has. And then she said, "It takes a spoon for me to get out of bed and get dressed. It takes a spoon for me to get my breakfast done. It takes a spoon for me to do whatever next thing she's going to do." And then maybe somebody has to go to work, and they're going to take 2 or 3 spoons to do that. We're already talking 6 spoons gone. Now she wants to see her friend, but she also wants to watch a movie at night. And she knows she can't do both because each of those is going to require spoons. And she will be depleted of energy by the time she gets to those 10 spoons. And she still has to get dinner, and she has to get ready for bed and get, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it's a great concept. I use it a lot in my talks to let people understand it. And so what Jordan's saying is, you know, she only has so many spoons. And like what you just said, Jennifer, if she wants to have quality time with her friend when it comes over, something's got to give. She can't do everything. I always say you can't do everything. So,
right.
Yeah, that's really, I'm glad you brought that up, because I love the spoon theory. It just makes so much sense.
They told us about the spoon theory when I was in rehab, I believe. Yeah, when I was doing intense rehab, and I think in Nebraska at Madonna Rehab Hospital. So that's what they told us about that, and they were like, that makes total sense.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah. It really does. And the other thing I wanted to bring up, too, is I was curious about your problems or disabilities, if any, that are from your brain injury, balance, perception, personality, et cetera. And we talked a little bit about the personality. But you wrote on your blog or on social media, and I'm not sure where I saw this, but you recently told a story on, I think it was social media, about how you went to the store for shampoo. And then your mom called to ask you to pick up hamburger meat. And you got the hamburger meat, but you forgot the shampoo, the item that you were going to the store for in the first place. And, you know, and we all forget things, of course. Sometimes we do. And it can be really annoying. But unfortunately, when a survivor of brain injury talks about forgetting, it is not the typical forgetting that we all do.
No.
Like, where are my keys? It's the kind of forgetting that persists and is a matter of the brain blocking information on a regular basis. And I know because it's got to be so annoying when somebody says, and I've heard this from so many survivors that I can really feel for them, but they'll say, oh, I just, you know, they may say it to somebody, oh, well, I just can't remember, or I forgot this or whatever. And everybody goes, oh, don't worry about it. I do that all the time. And that's annoying because, yes, everybody forgets, but not to the point of the kind of forgetting that a survivor does. And so I wanted to ask you, Jordan, do you forget often? And if so,
yes.
How do you deal with it?
So
I'm sorry.
You're fine. So when I was in the hospital, I started telling my mom that I felt like Dory from Finding Nemo, the short-term memory loss. I still say that. She hates when I say that. But ways that I combat that, though, like her recently. So I just went on a trip to North Carolina. So I wanted to make a list of what I was bringing and where I put it, just so I didn't get flustered since I was traveling by myself. Let's see. So I have a whole, list. I have my carry-on, suitcase, and my purse. And so what was in each one, and where was in the bag? So that way I can look at it and say, okay, this is in this bag. This is in this bag on this side. Just that way, my mind was clear. That way I didn't have to, call my mom and be like, hey, can you send me something? So I forgot it's underwear.
That would be bad.
I didn't forget underwear. So, yes. So that's one way of, combating that. Just making lots of lists on my phone.
Mm-hmm.
My phone has really been, the biggest tool in my recovery, ever, honestly. So
really?
Why don't you tell my mom? Yes. When I was in the hospital, I had my iPad. I didn't have my phone. And so I would send her voice messages through the iPad. And my mom?
Yeah, so when she was first becoming conscious, and so Jordan has a little bit of a special situation in that all this, as we keep saying, happened during COVID. And so COVID made everything crazy. And so I would have to leave the rehab at 6 o'clock at night, and she has, a brain injury. She's not in the right state of mind. So we gave her an iPad, and she figured out how to do voice messages because at the time she couldn't call people. She couldn't text, but she could make a voice message, and she would send us voice messages of what she needed or just her thoughts. And so that's kind of how it started. She would send us these voice messages, and then once she got a little bit better, she started using her phone for everything. So, she keeps a calendar on her phone, plus she also keeps a paper calendar, and then she keeps different lists on her phone, and then she has reminders on her phone, reminders about, speaking with a clear voice, because one of her hard things is speaking, and so speaking with a clear voice and speaking loudly, she gets her reminders, and then she also gets reminders on it's time to take her medications and things like that. So her phone is definitely her lifeline to everything, keeping herself organized for sure.
Because especially when you think about it, smartphones have only been available for the past how many years? But I mean, we had phones when David, we had phones, but I don't think they were smart at that time. When he had his injury, we had a phone, cell phones, but they didn't do everything that these phones do now. And so that's very fortunate that Jordan was able to maneuver aspects of the phone that can help to make her life easier. But you're right, I forgot about that COVID thing, and I know about it. I knew about it with Jordan. But that must have really put a wrench into it, because you said you were at the rehab, so they did allow you in?
So in the beginning, when Jordan was in, when she was in St. Louis at Mercy Hospital and she was in ICU, so Jordan came out of recovery that night having surgery, and they told us, you have 5 minutes with her. Her father and I had 5 minutes with her. And so they got her into the ICU. They let us look at her. They let us tell her that we loved her. And then they said we had to leave.
Oh, wow.
And I said to them,
for you.
Well, I said, is she going to be alive in the morning? And they said, we don't know.
We don't know, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Oh,
and I said, okay.
How hard that must have been on you.
It was terrible. And so they told us that one of us could come back the next morning and at 7 o'clock. And so the next morning I came back at 7 o'clock in the morning, and they said, basically one person could visit a day from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., just one person. And you weren't allowed to change people. So it was one person. So that first day I came back, she'd had surgery. You know, she was on a ventilator. She was unconscious. She was in her own coma. She wasn't in a medically induced coma. She was in a coma. And so they came in and they said, she's running a fever. And I said, okay. And they said, well, we have to test her for COVID, and that means you have to leave. And I couldn't believe that. I said, I don't care if she has COVID. I just want to stay with her. And they said no. And so I kind of dug in my heels, and then they had to get in administrative people. And I was livid. I said, I can't believe you're doing this to me. You're making me leave her. You know, I would have already been exposed by this point. So what, why? And so they finally said, no, you have to leave. And so I said, okay. And they did a COVID test on her, and they said, you can come back once we get the results. It'll take 4 to 5 hours. And it took 4 hours to get the results. And we live about 45 minutes from the hospital, so I was able to drive back. But for the entire time that she was there, she was only ever allowed to have one visitor. And because her injuries were so significant and she needed so much help, I was that one visitor. So her father did not see her the entire time she was there until one night I snuck him in. And then we went to rehab, and rehab was the same way, only one visitor.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So we left her and I mean, they took her in an ambulance, and I drove up, and my husband and one of our daughters had to stay in Lake St. Louis, and Jordan and I stayed in Nebraska for several months, but it was still the one person visitation policy. And so my husband was able to finally come up, and he could see her for a couple hours. It actually was 5 hours a day. It was about, we'd get to see her. And then we would have to leave, but it was so intensive, and she was finally conscious, and we would have to leave her, like I said, 6 o'clock at night. And I didn't know this till very long afterwards, but I'm going to get emotional.
No.
But she would lay in bed, and she would say to herself, this is not my fault. This is not my fault. This is not my fault. And she would say it over and over and over again, because she was trying to convince herself that this accident wasn't her fault. And she would lay there and she would cry, saying, this is not my fault. I didn't do this. And and nobody was there for her. Think about how damaging that is. Like, when you usually have people around you in these situations, and she's in a room totally alone by herself with a brain injury because of COVID, you know, the nurses are taking care of their other patients, and she's laying there in this bed with no one to hold her hand, no one to tell her that, you know, that it is okay. Yes, that was devastating. COVID, the first injury happened with the accident itself, and then COVID made a whole nother trauma on top of it.
Right. Yeah, a mental type trauma at that point, a psychological trauma,
for sure.
Just not being able to have your mama there when you need her, you know?
No, and when she was in ICU, I was scared to death. She would become conscious and not know where she was, you know, and to be surrounded by people in masks and not know how you got there and for your brain to be all scrambled.
And you know,
I mean, it's crazy. Mm-hmm.
And you know how busy those nurses were and how frantic they must have been too during that whole scene, you know, because overworked with all the COVID patients. So,
it must have been
really, really difficult for everyone in concern there, but the patients for sure, you know, because, yeah, like you said, they're in pain, they're hurting, they need the help, and it's not as easy. I mean, it's hard to be in the hospital no matter what, but when you
mm-hmm.
complicate it with COVID, that has got to be just horrendous.
Well, yeah, it was definitely an experience that I always say that years from now they'll do studies on these people that have these injuries during COVID and see what the ramifications of the mental things that COVID ended up putting on people. Because, you know, the hospital staff was overworked. They were overworked. They were sick.
Mm-hmm.
The rehab staff was overworked. They were sick. We weren't, I'm sure with David, you were allowed to participate in rehab. We didn't get to participate in rehab. We didn't get to help her with any rehab because of COVID.
No. Mm-hmm.
She had to rehab by herself.
Yeah, and I was with David.
And we weren't allowed to be there.
Yeah, no. From the moment David had his brain injury, I was with him almost constantly. For the first 4 days, I never left. First 4 days. Then he went off to Columbia Medical Center, Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. So I had just a short time to run home, shower, and then get over to that hospital. And I was there most of the time. I was there from like 7 in the morning until 9 or 10 at night. So
mm-hmm.
I was with him all the time. And during rehab, the same thing. I quit. I didn't quit my job. I took a leave right there. I had to substitute my classroom. But I was there the whole time. And you know what? The thing is, what David said to me later, because although he was in a coma from the beginning, he didn't worry, he said, because he knew I was there. He felt safe because he knew that I wouldn't let anything happen. Yeah? So it's really important to have family there, you know, cheerleading the survivor on. There's just no question about that. And to have to do what you guys did during the COVID time is just doubly hard, doubly, triply hard.
Yeah. And there's so many, like, hospitals that aren't qualified to deal with brain injuries, which is why we went to Madonna, Nebraska. So, so we had to leave all of our family and, like, go there. And my mom was by herself, and I was in the hospital by myself during COVID. So it's just, like, just really, it was traumatizing. I really felt bad for my mom because she was, like, conscious and by herself. So she stayed in, like, it was similar to Ronald McDonald House on the hospital campus.
Uh-huh.
So that's where she stayed. She just walked over when she was allowed to visit. But, yep, so I just feel so bad.
Yeah. Well, Jordan, you're really fortunate that you have your parents in the ring with you there.
Yeah.
You know, that they are your supporters. And I know you know that. But it's just because a lot of people don't have that. They don't have the family and friend support, and it's really difficult for them. And it, you know, more just more difficult for them because they don't. And not to say it's any less difficult for anybody that has family, but a lot of times people lose family and friends after they've had a brain injury. And I know you mentioned that some of your friends kind of drifted off into the sunset. Can you talk about that?
Yep. So, on a good note, before I get to the sad note, so my best friend lives in Iowa, yes. So I met her in college. And so she was living in Washington, Iowa at the time. And she was a NICU nurse. And so my mom called her. And so she told what happened. And so Claire said, well, I'll come wave at her through the window since she couldn't come into the hospital. She was all ready to come visit. Like, she told my mom, she said, I'll come eat dinner with you. I'll come, like, just switch off with you, whatever you want. Like, whatever you need, like, I'll be there. So I'm just very grateful for her. But I do have other friends that, like, just kind of stopped coming by. Yes, like, stopped texting, stopped calling. So then I was kind of disappointed because I couldn't do anything. I couldn't get out of the house. I couldn't drive. I couldn't do a lot of, like, things I'd normally do. So I wasn't getting out, and I wasn't seeing people that you just really need to be surrounded by people when, like, you have a brain injury or basically any injury or any illness. Going to be around people that you know and love, then, like, they stop coming around because you can't drive or you can't do things, so that just becomes a major issue.
Yeah.
Major upset.
And that's so common. Yeah, that's so common about with so many people, and that, you know, you just lose, they just, you aren't the same person that they had in their life and valued in their lives before. And David actually had a very close friend. He was a race driver of open wheel cars, and we had very, very close friends. In fact, they even came to the hospital. The one was in New York City at the time, but his wife was in San Francisco on a job, and she quit her job, but I mean, she just got on a plane and got there that night. And so they were there for us. That's how close that we were. And then they were there for us for maybe a couple months or so afterwards, and then, you know, disappeared. You know, and the wife still sees us, but the husband will have nothing to do anymore. And the wife explains that her husband just couldn't bear to see his very close friend in the situation that he was in. And I can understand that, but it hurt. Yeah. It hurt David a lot we'd still see his wife. And, but now no word from the other person. And I've written to him and everything, but it's like, okay, well, there's nothing you can do about it. You know, I'm sorry that happened, because I think you would have valued David in a different way. You would have still had that same friendship, but in a different way. And people don't know. I think they just become, I don't know, what is it?
They don't know what to say.
Maybe they're scared.
Yes. Yeah, they're scared.
Maybe
they don't know what to say, think of you the wrong thing.
Yeah. Or maybe they think it's going to happen to them. If it can happen to you, it could happen to them too.
Right.
You know, all of those things. So I understand that, but I wish people would understand how hurtful it is. Because, again, I talk to so many people that have talked about this issue. And it's about globally, hurtful. They just really hate it. I'm watching my time now, and there are a few questions I really, really want to get to. And one of the subject I'm dying to talk to you about, in the slideshow, there is a photo of you hugging a little black and white puff of fur with cute little eyes peeking out. And he's adorable. So can you tell us the story of how you got your little pup, Brew, and how he helps you in your recovery.
Yes, he's so cute. I will talk. Thank you. I will talk forever about Brew. So when was that, Mom?
We could do a whole show on animals.
Yeah, we could. That was July.
That you got him.
No, but like when we got to pick him out, like June?
Yeah.
So I was on a list before the crash for a breeder to get a puppy. And so I think I was about 7 on the list, 6 or 7. And my mom was on the list as well. So, like, when you're on the list, you put a deposit down, and then you pay the dog out, then you pay the rest once you pick them up. And so we were both on the list. And so I was number 6, so I was like, I'm never going to get a dog from this litter. This litter was only 2 dogs, just 2. And I was like, I'm number 6. There's no way I will get him or either of them. I really had no opinion on which one I wanted to get. But so I was like, well. And so at the time, my mom was taking care of me 24/7. She was being my 24/7 caregiver. And my Aunt Kim had lost her dog. I must have thought, Mom, like
a couple months.
Yeah, a couple months that she had like forever. She loved that dog. And so my mom gave her a spot to my aunt. And so I came down the list. We were at Waffle House. And they were like, okay, well, then no one has chosen anyone yet, any dog. So you have your choice of the two, Tom or Jerry. And so he said, which one's calmer? And she said, Tom is calmer. And so we're like, okay, yes, we'll take Tom. So my aunt took Jerry. Actually, my grandma has a dog from the same breeder with the same parents. So they're full brothers, just from different litters. Yes. So then he went to pick him up July 7th.
Mm-hmm.
July 7th, and he has just been the greatest blessing I've ever had. He's, 16 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Cavalier mix, the poodle. His name's Brew. And so we have our first dog. His name is Baby, that they gave her the name of the shelter, so we didn't change it, and we just kept it. So we got our second dog. We're like, well, it needs to start with a B, because we're all J's. So all dogs need to start with a B name. So my dad works at Nantucket Bush Brewery, so we named him Barley. So I was like, well, I just keep it the beer theme if I can, and do a B name. Then I came up with Brew. Actually, my mom did. She came up with Brew.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just a little Brew Bear. Oh, I love him.
Aww.
He is such a good dog.
Yeah. So this is Jennifer. So when Jordan got Brew, he was a reason for her to make sure that she was up every day, because she had to take him out to the bathroom. She had to train him. She had to feed him. And so they like bonded up.
He's very attached.
He's very attached to her, and he's very calm and, you know, but he really gave her her life meaning at a point where, where she really needed that meaning. She needed somebody to need her, and she needed, you know, to be accountable for something. And Brew, it wouldn't work for every person with a brain injury. I don't advocate that, but since she lives home with her dad and I, and you know, it was a great thing. We tried to let her be as independent as she could, and her and Brew just bonded right away, and yeah, they're best friends for sure.
For sure. He's such an angel. We actually have...
That is such a wonderful story.
Yes, we have 6 dogs from that breeder. So,
I can tell you, I would never have understood till about a year ago, your feelings for your pups. Because for all my life, I have not been fond of dogs. I have not
really
wanted them near me or to touch me, or I could not touch them. I have just been really adverse feelings towards dogs for something. I didn't mind if they were in the room with me, just as long as they just left me alone. And then a year ago, it was during COVID, but it had nothing to do with COVID. We couldn't go to – I liked my son's dog. He's about the only dog in the world I like. and I would have taken that dog in a minute. And I obviously, my son wasn't going to give it up. So I told my husband, I said, I really wanted, well, because we couldn't see the dog that year, I said, I really want to get a dog. And he said, okay, because he knew I would never get a dog. I mean, everybody in my life knows that I'm not going to have a dog because they have seen my reaction to their dogs. So, and he said, yeah, sure, go ahead. And I did my research, and I searched dogs all over the place. I wanted a little dog. And my dog, your Brew, I should say, reminds me so much of my little pup that I rescued last June, not this past, from a clinic here, a Humane Society type thing. And she was 13 when I got her, so she's 14 now. And I absolutely adore her. So I know what you're saying now, which I would not have understood if we talked 2 years ago. And and I do think that your pup, Brew, probably is a great help to you during your recovery. Like your mom said,
absolutely.
You know, it gives you that purpose, You know, somebody's counting on you.
Yep, exactly. We say he's my little therapy dog.
Yeah, even though, I know. And it's like, I don't know. I mean, I'll have to send you a picture. Have you ever seen my dog online? Do they ever see anything online? You have?
Yeah,
you
sent me a picture of your dog.
Send you. Yeah. So, I mean, they're very similar in size and everything, and their cuteness.
Right.
So, that's so cool. So,
there's pleasure heartstrings.
No, they do. They absolutely do. I'm looking to see what my notes, what's something most important that I want to get to you. I wanted to bring up, because I saw something on your website about celebrities who also have traumatic brain injury, which only proves that, brain injury is not discriminating.
Right.
It happens to anybody. You can have a lot of money. You can have fame, but it happens. And the only one I knew on your blog was the ABC News journalist Bob Woodruff, who received a traumatic brain injury when a roadside bomb exploded as he was covering the war in Iraq. And that was about a year after David's brain injury. So I contacted his wife, Lee, because I felt I knew what she was going through. I mean, I just like, oh, my gosh, this is horrible. And Lee eventually got to talk. And she eventually also endorsed my book. There's her little blurb is on the back of my book, which is really cool. But and then I was surprised to see book authors like A.A. Milne, the author of Winnie the Pooh, and also Roald Dahl, who I loved, The Charlie and Chocolate Factory. And then there's Lady Gaga, Tina Turner, Justin Bieber, Randy Travis, all from the music world. Further and looked at other people online to see who else was in it because you got me really curious. But then even President Abraham Lincoln had a brain injury when he got hit in the head when a mule kicked him when he was 10 years old. So all of these folks have suffered brain injury, and they have shown that you can be very accomplished even with a brain injury.
Right. Exactly.
It depends, of course, how your brain injury is. But the reason I bring this up is because, Jordan, you mentioned earlier that you completed your BA degree and before your injury. But what's remarkable is that you said you were in the middle of getting you're working on your master's degree. And we only have like a couple of minutes, but I just want to say kudos to you for doing that. That's going to be really hard. What made you, want to continue?
So if I ever want to go out to work, which I do, I need to be able to have a job that's flexible with having a brain injury that, like, I can do. I can't just be stuck behind a desk all day anymore, like, because my brain won't be able to handle that. So I was like, well, I should continue my master's. The more education I have, the more likely I am to get a job and not stuck behind a desk. And so my mom suggested that I take an undergraduate level class just to figure out how I learn again. And so I decided to sign up for a digital marketing course from University of Missouri, St. Louis. And before the class started this August, I emailed the professor, Perry Drake, and so I said, I just basically introduced myself. And I said, hi, my name is Jordan Fowler. I have a brain injury from a car crash a little more than a year and a half ago, and I was getting my master's, but now I'm trying to get back into it and figure out how I learn again. Because with a brain injury, mm-hmm. like, you could learn totally differently than how you did before.
Yeah.
Like, I get very distracted now. Like, I used to never get distracted. So, like, just having to try and overcome that and find ways to deal with that. And so he emailed me back, and he said, take the graduate level class. It's exactly the same except for one assignment. You'll be fine, I promise. You'll do great. And then he was actually in a motorcycle accident a few weeks ago, so or before class started. So now it's on Zoom instead of in on campus, which actually that means he records the classes. We are on Zoom on Tuesday mornings, and he records the class. And so I'm able to go back and watch the class as many times as possible, which is fabulous. And then also I can, he records his other lessons and stuff, so I'm able to go back and review them that way. So that way I, since I have the short-term memory loss, it just gives me another avenue or ways to accommodate that. And then I do have accommodations through disability at the university, so I have double the amount of tests and quiz time and things of that nature. I can't remember anything else, but yeah.
Love it. That's terrific, and I wish you so much luck in doing that. And
thank you.
You have, you know, I was right when I read your post there about your positivity and your go-getter, you know, go girl, you know. And
thank
one
you.
Of the things, and I'm going to have to end it with this, is you said in one of your questions, a brain injury will only limit you if you let it. And and I like those words to do it. I mean, you've got, it's hard. It's, nobody would ever say that a brain injury is not difficult, no matter what your level of brain injury is. But if you can try your hardest to keep a positive attitude and keep moving forward and just do the best you can, that's all any one of us can do. So, Jordan, I want to thank you so much for being a guest on my show. And Jennifer, thank you for helping out on this and giving your input. And we'd love to have you back on.
Thank you.
Jennifer, Bella, I'd love to have your opinion on as a caregiver. On that note, let me just say that, again, I'm thanking Jordan Fowler and her mom, Jennifer Fowler, for sharing so much of your life with us and offering hope for other survivors. And you can always learn more about Jordan on her blog. And I don't have the thing down, but if you put Jordan Fowler into Google, it will come up, because that's how I found that. So you can read and also check out my blog, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com, and look at the interview, Survivors Speak Out, Survivors Speak Out. And you'll see Jordan's complete interview there, as well as you'll also find this live interview, as a podcast archived on my site, and it will be under On the Air Show menu. And on that site, there is a category for brain injury resources. There's a lot of information there about COVID that David wrote about and used his scientific knowledge from his day. And so check that out. There's a category called Itty Bitty Giant Steps. And so if you have an accomplishment you'd like to share, contact me on my blog or, contact me at Donna O'Donnell, DonnaO'Donnell@figureski.com. DonnaO'Donnell@figureski.gmail.com. Okay, you can read more about my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, at DonnaFigureski.com. And on my next show, which will be coming up in November, and I'm pulling up my calendar really fast, the first Sunday in November is November 6th. So we'll be talking to a panel at that time, and I'll be letting you know what that topic is going to be about. So remember to tune in every second and fourth Sunday at 5:30 p.m. Pacific time to listen to Lisa Dreyer. She is the host of Mess with MS. That would be the first and third Sunday is me. The second and fourth Sunday is Lisa. And next up, it should be Moving Forward with Coach KJ and Dr. Valentina. So if you loved my show tonight, tell 10 of your friends. And if you hated it, well, tell 10 of your enemies. That works for me. So I'll see you in November. Boy, this year went fast, didn't it? And again, to Jordan and to Jennifer, thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Thank you.
Goodbye, world.
Thank you.
Good night.